content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the February 26, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Scalia's death triggers a battle over the court. What happened? The unexpected death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia ignited a fierce political battle this week as Republicans insisted that the right to appoint his successor should go to the next president rather than President Obama. Scalia, a conservative icon who left an indelible imprint during his 29 years on the court, died of natural causes at the age of 79 during a hunting trip at a Texas ranch. Republican Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell immediately declared that Scalia's replacement, who must be approved by the Republican-controlled Senate, should be chosen by the winner of the presidential election rather than let Obama shift the political balance of the closely divided court. The American people should have a voice in the selection, McConnell said. That stance was widely backed by other Republican senators and the party's presidential candidates. President Obama vowed to put forward an indisputably qualified candidate and said Senate Republicans had an obligation to hold hearings and a vote. The Constitution is pretty clear about what is supposed to happen now, he said. If Obama's nominee is blocked, the Supreme Court will continue ruling on cases with only 8 members for at least 11 months. When the justices are deadlocked 4-4, the lower court's decision is upheld without creating a legal precedent. 9 of the 13 U.S. courts of appeal have a majority of Democratic appointees. The appeals court favored liberals in several current cases, including challenges of Obama's restrictions on power plant emissions and of mandatory contraception coverage in the Affordable Care Act. But lower court rulings went against Obama's executive action to shield 4 million undocumented immigrants from deportation and upheld Texas abortion restrictions. What the editorial said: the obstructionism being threatened by Senate Republicans is outrageous, said the Los Angeles Times. The American people already have a voice in nominating Supreme Court justices. They spoke when they reelected Obama for a 4-year, not 3-year term. Conservatives cite the Thurman Rule, a supposed tradition that the Senate doesn't act on judicial nominations during the administration's final year. But that rule has no formal status and has not been consistently honored. A Democratic-controlled Senate confirmed Justice Anthony Kennedy in the election year of 1988, after he was nominated in November 1987. If Republicans refuse to consider any Obama nominee, their partisanship and disrespect for the court will be blatantly obvious. The reality is that no one Obama nominates has a chance to be confirmed, said the Wall Street Journal. The stakes are simply too great. Several recent landmark rulings, the right to bear arms enshrined in District of Columbia versus Heller, the striking down of campaign funding limits in Citizens United, were decided 5-4 and could easily be overturned by a liberal majority. Besides, Democrats would feel the same way if the positions were reversed. Indeed, Senator Chuck Schumer called on his fellow Democrats in 2007 to reject sight unseen any of George W. Bush's nominees if a Supreme Court vacancy came up. This incendiary high-stakes confirmation battle will be front and center in the election, said the Chicago Tribune. Each party will motivate its base with dire warnings of what laws and precedents a new justice might help overturn, and presidential candidates will be pressured to name whom they'd select if they won. It's often said that the court follows the election returns. this year, it will shape them. What the columnist said. Republicans are taking an astonishing gamble, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate.com. If they retake the White House and keep the Senate red, they win their big bet and will be able to appoint their dream Scalia successor. But if the Democrats swoop to a double victory, the new president will be free to pick a very liberal nominee, and no conservative president would be safe. Not Heller, not Citizens United, not the death penalty. Why don't Republicans at least consider a compromise candidate? The party's base wouldn't stand for it, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. Besides, it's the Democrats' fault that the nomination system is broken beyond recognition. They created a new standard for rejecting candidates in ideologically decisive nominations in 1987, when they blocked the nomination of Ronald Reagan appointee Robert Bork. Republicans should hold firm, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Obama has trampled on the Constitution and the rightful powers of Congress at every opportunity, and the Senate owes him nothing. If Republicans keep this vacancy open for the rest of Obama's term, the partisan warfare in Washington will get even worse, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Both parties used to defer to the president on Supreme Court appointments. Scalia was confirmed 98-0. But the last four justices have all been opposed by a majority of the opposition party. As partisan rancor has grown, Republicans have grown more procedurally radical, flouting formal and informal norms that make government work, to block Democrats from doing anything at all. If the GOP retains its Senate majority, it could mean that no justice could be confirmed until there's a Republican president. The court may be stuck with eight members or fewer for years to come. And a second main story, GOP attacks get personal ahead of South Carolina primary. What happened? Donald Trump still held a commanding poll lead on the eve of the potentially pivotal South Carolina primary as he and his Republican rivals slugged it out in a series of increasingly personal attacks. A week of acrimony began with a GOP debate in Greenville, South Carolina, that at times resembled a schoolyard brawl. Trump drew boos when he challenged Jeb Bush's assertion that his president and his brother George W. Bush kept the nation safe. The World Trade Center came down during the reign of George Bush, Trump said. That is not safe. The GOP frontrunner also suggested the Bush administration tricked the country into the Iraq War. They said there were weapons of mass destruction, Trump said. There were none. While campaigning for his brother in North Charleston this week, former President Bush fired a retaliatory shot at Trump, declaring, "We do not need someone in the Oval Office that mirrors and inflames our anger and frustration." The clash between Trump and Ted Cruz also grew increasingly bitter. After the Texas senator ran ads that accused Trump of holding liberal positions on abortion and gay marriage, the billionaire branded Cruz the single biggest liar I've ever come across. A public policy polling survey of South Carolina Republicans showed Trump leading with 35%, followed by Cruz and Florida Senator Marco Rubio with 18% each. A CNN ORC survey gave Trump a 38-22 edge over Cruz, though Trump's support dipped to 31% in post-debate interviews. What the editorial said. South Carolina Republicans should cast a vote against Donald J. Trump, said the Greenville News. He has failed to articulate conservative philosophies on key issues, and his ugly rhetoric shows he lacks the temperament needed in a leader. It's hard to imagine that he could engage in subtle diplomacy during times when a light touch is needed. No, a reality show mentality will not win the day in an international crisis, or in November. Rubio is the best-positioned GOP candidate to win the White House, said the Las Vegas Review-Journal. After a fifth-place finish in New Hampshire, Rubio emerged from the South Carolina debate with a performance of the night, deftly defending his foreign policy proposals to reassert American influence in the world. Rubio snagged the endorsement of South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley this week, and polls show he's the only Republican capable of beating Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders in a head-to-head matchup. What the columnist said: millions of American voters agree with Trump that the Iraq War was a mistake, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. Unfortunately for the real estate magnate, this isn't the general election. He needs to win the GOP nomination, and most Republicans still support the war and former President Bush. But if Trump can secure the nomination, his break with party orthodoxy will stand as an asset, not a liability. For all of his anger and vulgarity, Trump understands that Americans may want a Republican in November, but they don't want a return to the Bush years. Meanwhile, Cruz's unfavorables have skyrocketed, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. He flip-flops on issues, uses deceptive campaign tactics, and his strained, awkward smile and cringeworthy attempts at humor don't help matters. Despised on both sides of the aisle, Cruz has a narrow, ultra-conservative base. He's counted on Trump voters falling away and turning to him, but that's just not happening. It is hard to get people to vote for you if they don't like you. If Trump does win in South Carolina, he'll be going straight to the Republican nomination, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. His dishonest attacks on George W. Bush, who has an 87% approval rating in South Carolina, a state filled with evangelicals and retired military, would seem politically suicidal. But Trump has proved again and again that he knows things we don't know about the emotions roiling in the American underbelly. Rubio and Jeb will battle it out for the tide of establishment anti-Trump, but it's not clear they can beat the bullying billionaire. They're hungry, ambitious, even desperate men, but they still operate according to the basic rules of elementary human conduct. And while we're on this page, a shorter note from the "It Wasn't All Bad" section. An American World War II veteran has reunited with his wartime sweetheart 72 years after they last said goodbye. Norman Norwood Thomas was a 21-year-old paratrooper when he fell in love with Joyce Morris, then 17, in London in 1944. They spent a precious few days together, but lost contact after Norwood was sent to join the Allied invasion of Normandy and later returned to the U.S. The pair recently reconnected over the internet, and online donors paid for Thomas, now 93, to fly to southern Australia, where Morris, 88, lives. "This is about the most wonderful thing that could have happened to me," Thomas said as he hugged his former best girl. Our controversy of the week: Scalia, how history will judge his complex legacy. The word "brilliant" is overused, said Mona Chirin in NationalReview.com. But in the case of Justice Antonin Scalia, it may be too weak. In his 29 years on the Supreme Court, Scalia used his caustic wit and penetrating intelligence to bring new spirit and vigor to what had previously been the dullest of our three branches of government. His arguments didn't always carry the day. Indeed, he wrote more of his famously blistering dissents than he did majority opinions. But by championing and mainstreaming the conservative legal philosophy called textualism or originalism, which holds that the courts should interpret the text of the Constitution by, in Scalia's words, what it meant when it was adopted, his impact on American jurisprudence was profound. Scalia wrote several of the court's most historic opinions, said Stephen Calabresi in USAtoday.com, including the 2007 Heller decision, which established for the first time that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to keep and bear firearms. but it was Scalia's passionate commitment to his judicial philosophy that inspired generations of conservative lawyers and made him the most important justice in American history. Good riddance, said Paul Rosenberg in Salon.com. For all Scalia's personal charm and vaunted devotion to the rule of law, this was a jurist who cared not in the least for real human beings affected by his rulings. He wrote that condemned prisoners should be executed even if they could provide evidence after being sentenced that they were actually innocent, and that society had as much right to criminalize homosexual conduct as it did murder or bestiality. In the infamous Citizens United decision, Scalia decided that when the founders said free speech, they meant money, a ruling that accelerated the corruption of our political process by corporations and the wealthy. And who could forget his nakedly partisan, circular logic in concurring with the Bush versus Gore ruling that handed the 2000 presidential election to the Republicans? If Florida were allowed to recount the votes of its citizens, Scalia reasoned, it might reveal that Al Gore had won the election, thus casting a cloud over the legitimacy of the rightful president, George W. Bush. Yes, Scalia probably let his partisan biases influence his decision in Bush versus Gore, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. But he had also had a long record of putting originalist principle over partisan conservatism. He confessed his scorn for scruffy, bearded, sandal-wearing idiots who burned the flag, but nonetheless upheld their right to burn it. Scalia's powerfully written opinions were impossible to ignore, said David Rivkin in LATimes.com. And today, even liberal justices must at least confront the text of the Constitution before ruling as they prefer. Scalia's originalism was more of a pose than a philosophy, said law professor Eric Posner in Slate.com. It let him pretend that he was politically neutral while scorning his colleagues as activist hacks. But it was no coincidence that the 18th century values embodied in the Constitution happened to dovetail with Scalia's conservative Catholic beliefs. When the text's words did not support the result he wanted, he simply ignored them. In one case, he ruled that Native Americans must obey the laws even if it conflicted with their religious beliefs. But in another, Scalia found a right for his fellow conservative Christians to be exempt from it. Those maddening inconsistencies were part of what made him such a compelling figure, said Dahlia Lithwick, also in Slate.com. Whenever he was asked to defend the indefensible Bush versus Gore decision, he would reply with partisan relish, "Get over it." But we will not get over Scalia for a long, long time. It was a good week for strange bedfellows after a group of prostitutes called Hookers for Hillary endorsed Hillary Clinton in the upcoming Nevada caucuses. Women should help other women, right? Said Entis Love, a 26-year-old sex worker. It was a good week for looking for a new job after falling oil revenues and Western bombing forced ISIS leaders to stop giving their fighters free energy drinks and Snickers bars. You can sense the frustration, said one Syrian exile. The morale is down. It was a good week for conspiracy theorists after Texas officials said Antonin Scalia's family declined to have an autopsy performed on the 79-year-old Supreme Court justice. Bloggers and talk radio show host immediately speculated that President Obama orchestrated Scalia's killing. But it was a bad week for Sir Paul McCartney, who was twice turned away from a Grammy after party because the bouncer didn't recognize the former Beatle. How VIP do we gotta get, the ex-Beatle said to his entourage, which included singer Beck and actor Woody Harrelson. It was a bad week for sound effects after Montana police surrounded a home with weapons drawn following neighbors' report of screaming, gunshots, and flashing lights. It turned out that the family was watching a TV zombie drama called The Walking Dead. And it was a bad week for partial honesty after a New York man who lost his wallet had his license and credit cards returned along with a note from the finder. "I kept the cash because I needed weed," the note read. "The Metro card because, well, the fare's $2.75 now, and the wallet because it's kind of cool." On the briefing page, the history of socialism. Where did Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders get his political philosophy? What is socialism? Broadly, it's a political and economic system under which the means of production are owned by the community as a whole, with the government ensuring the equitable distribution of wealth. But socialism has taken many forms. Socialism is an exceedingly fuzzy term used to label an extraordinarily wide array of political and economic beliefs, said scholar Paul Bryans. Socialism has morphed into Soviet-style communism and spawned Latin American dictatorships, while in Europe, many countries combine socialistic principles with capitalism and democracy. In the U.S., programs that opponents once condemned as socialism, such as Social Security and Medicare, are now deeply embedded in our society. Still, socialism has largely dwelled on the margins of American politics until it was revived by the campaign of Democratic presidential contender Bernie Sanders. What is Sanders' preferred form of socialism? A self-described democratic socialist, Sanders believed government should aggressively use taxes and social programs to limit income inequality and provide health care, daycare, and a college education to all without charge. But he doesn't spurn private enterprise. "I don't believe government should own the means of production," the Vermont senator says. "I do believe the middle class and working families who produce the wealth deserve a fair deal." Sanders' model social democracy is Denmark, which tops polls of the world's happier countries, but also has one of the world's highest tax rates, averaging about 60%. When did socialism arise? It began as a response to the dire poverty and inhumane working conditions in the industrialized Europe in the early 19th century. One of the first thinkers called a socialist was Robert Owen, an idealistic Welsh mill owner who in the 1820s created a number of short-lived utopian communities, basically collectives, in Britain and the American Midwest. But socialism really took off in mid-century, spurred by the writings of German philosopher Karl Marx and the rise of labor unions. Socialists rejected the argument that the wealthy deserve their wealth because they created it, Brian says, instead believing that wealth is created by the working class and wrongfully appropriated to the rich. How did it spread to the U.S.? Mainly via Marxist German immigrants, who spearheaded the establishment of the Socialist Labor Party, the SLP, in 1876. The first socialist to hold public office in the U.S. was Fred Hoch, a shoe store owner elected to the Sheboygan, Wisconsin City Council in 1897. 4 years later, ex-SLP members and others formed the Socialist Party of America, which over the next two decades elected two U.S. congressmen, dozens of state legislators, and more than 100 mayors. They pushed for public ownership of utilities and transportation facilities, said political scientist Peter Dreyer, as well as expanded parks, libraries, and playgrounds, and a living wage for workers. The face of the party was Eugene V. Debs, a fiery railroad union leader who ran for president 5 times. But by the 1920s, U.S. socialism had fallen far out of favor. What happened? The Socialist Party opposed America's entry into World War I and was widely condemned as unpatriotic. In 1917, Congress passed the Espionage Act, making it a crime to speak out against the war or oppose the draft. Thousands of socialists, including Debs, were subsequently arrested. At the same time, Russia's Bolshevik Revolution caused a Red Scare in the U.S., a panicky fear that a similar worker revolt might occur here. Suspected radicals were rounded up and jailed, and nativists demanded an end to immigration from Italy and Eastern Europe, which they saw as hotbeds of communist sentiment. Is socialism the same as communism? No, Marx envisioned communism as a higher and purer form of socialism, in which all private property would become obsolete, class distinctions would dissolve, and goods and services would flow freely from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. In the Soviet Union, China, Cuba, and other communist countries, Marx's idealistic vision produced a grim reality, with economic growth stalling and an authoritarian ruling class appropriating much of the meager wealth for itself, while murderously suppressing all dissent. During the Cold War, socialist and communist were often used interchangeably in the U.S. in what political scientist Lawrence Quill calls shorthand for all things un-American. Is socialism un-American? Many Americans have conflicted attitudes about socialism, best illustrated by the Tea Party activist who demanded that government get its hands off my Medicare. But when a Gallup poll asked Americans last year whether they would consider voting for 11 categories of presidential candidate, socialist ranked last, garnering 47% behind Muslim and atheists. Among 18 to 29-year-olds, however, 69% had no problem voting for a socialist. Why the huge disparity? People in their 20s have no memory of the Soviet Union or the Cold War, but did come of age during and after the 2008 financial crisis. To young people feeling great economic insecurity, sharing the wealth sounds like less like a threat than like a promise. We're on the best columns now. We'll take two this week from the U.S. The first, the need for a centrist alternative. If Michael Bloomberg wants to perform a real public service, said Morton Kondracki, he'll use his vast wealth to help fund a robust centrist movement. Bloomberg has said he's weighing an independent presidential run to offer an alternative to Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, should they be nominated. But what this deeply polarized country needs is not a one-off candidate, but a true moderate political movement that lasts beyond 2016 and might develop into a real third party. The GOP has moved to the far right, and the Democrats have moved to the far left, while polls find that 40% of voters identify themselves as moderate. On issues such as gun control, climate change, immigration, and abortion, most voters support common-sense centrist positions, not the black-and-white absolutists of the partisans. Bloomberg has little or no chance of being elected president because he's not charismatic and has no national base of support, but he could use some of his $37 billion to help organize various centrist and anti-polarization groups into a real movement. Saving the American political system from extremism would be the best act of philanthropy I can imagine. Why Sanders plays down his Jewishness. After his landslide victory in the New Hampshire primary, said Gal Beckerman, Bernie Sanders told his cheering supporters, I am the son of a Polish immigrant. Polish? Sanders that night became the first Jew ever to win a presidential nominating contest in American history. Yet the breakthrough nature of Sanders' candidacy is barely mentioned, including by him. That has a lot to do with the kind of American Jew Sanders represents. The Vermont senator hails from a tradition of fiercely secular Jewish socialists who rejected Zionism and instead sought justice through solidarity with the rest of the working class. These Jews, often immigrants from Eastern Europe, adopted socialism as a new kind of faith, revering Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal instead of the Rebs and the Torah. With roots like those, it's no surprise that Sanders rarely speaks of his Jewishness, never attends synagogue, and exhibits little interest in Israel. In that respect, he's like many liberal American Jews. That's why the Jewish establishment didn't greet Sanders' historic win by hoisting him up in the chair like a joyous bar mitzvah boy. And an international column from Pakistan, The Warped Priorities of Islamic Clerics. Islamic clerics are squandering their moral authority, says Ifran Hussein. Why don't we see fatwas in support of the right of every child to food? Most of the Muslim world is socially and economically backward, and most of its people are poor. You'd think that clerics would put pressure on governments to follow the precepts of Islamic charity and provide education and health care to all. Instead, in nearly every Muslim-majority country, clerics focus on enforcing the subjugation of women and outlawing all forms of fun, like playing chess in Saudi Arabia or practicing yoga in Malaysia. In Pakistan, the Council of Islamic Ideology just issued a series of misogynistic rulings that uphold child marriage and make it harder for women to divorce. Why is religion being turned into such a joyless experience? It wasn't always like this. The Pakistan of my boyhood was far more tolerant, and the Islam practiced then far more compassionate. But that was before the Saudis came here and built hundreds of mosques and madrasas to spread Wahhabism, their harsh interpretation of the faith. Liberals love to say Islam is a religion of peace that is hijacked by terrorists. In reality, the faith has been hijacked by the clergy, many of whom preach angry extremism. And the last word, our in-depth article, Surviving Solitary Confinement. Spending years in isolation can have a devastating effect on the mind. Writer Susie Nielsen speaks to prisoners who survived and even thrived with the help of their imagination. With a sigh, Johnny Perez rises from his plastic chair, unfolds his lanky frame, and extends his wingspan until the tips of his middle fingers graze the walls. It was from here to here, he says. I know because I used to do this all the time. Until recently, these measurements, 10 feet by 6 feet, fit his entire life. 2 years ago, Perez was released on parole after serving 13 years in prison in New York. He spent 3 of those years in solitary confinement. Sitting across from Perez, you wonder how he feels in this space, a tiny, harshly lit conference room at the Urban Justice Center on Wall Street in Manhattan. Whether it brings back traumatic memories, or feels like home, or both. While there is no universally agreed upon definition, modern solitary, also called supermax or the box, is commonly understood to involve confinement to a small cell for 22 to 24 hours a day. Prisoners are not allowed to participate in leisure activities, have hobbies, or speak to others. They are often shackled when they leave their cells, if they ever leave. Perez said he eventually stopped wanting to. Solitary confinement has been linked to a variety of profound negative psychological outcomes, including suicidal tendencies and spatial and cognitive distortions. Confinement-induced stress can shrink parts of the brain, including the hippocampus, which is responsible for memory, spatial orientation, and control of emotions. Prisoners often report bizarre and disturbing subjective experiences after they leave Supermax. Some say the world regularly collapses in on itself. Others report they are unable to sustain ordinary conversations or think clearly for any length of time. The psychiatrist Sandra Shank puts it this way. It's a standard psychiatric concept. If you put people in isolation, they will go insane. Yet Perez pauses when he is asked how it felt to be confined for so long. That's an interesting question, he says, because in a sense you are confined, and in other senses, you're free. Perez says he left solitary confinement a better man than he entered it. He is now fully rehabilitated and works for the Urban Justice Center, where he helps recently released inmates adjust to the world outside. Perez calls himself an anomaly and says he can only guess at the factors that made him succeed where so many others have failed. However he did it, what's clear is that the process began with his own imagination. At the end of this short paragraph, stop reading, close your eyes, imagine yourself hitting a tennis ball. Do it again. Can you see yourself hitting the ball? Can you visualize its arc through the sky? Does it veer off course? And can you imagine yourself hitting it better next time? If so, you are using a technique that has helped many people survive prison. Edith Bone, a professor of medicine and translator who spoke six languages fluently, constructed an abacus out of a stale bread and made an inventory of her sprawling vocabulary while imprisoned in Hungary after World War II. Hussein al-Sharistani, Saddam Hussein's former chief scientific advisor, spent a decade in solitary confinement at the Abu Ghraib prison near Baghdad. He survived, according to the BBC, by taking refuge in a world of abstractions, making up mathematical problems, which he then tried to solve. He is now Iraq's Minister of Higher Education and Scientific Research. While imprisoned in the German concentration camp during World War II, the Russian Jewish mathematics professor Jacob Trachtenberg developed an innovative method of performing rapid mental calculations known today as the Trachtenberg system. Summoning up mental imagery is a quasi-perceptual experience, according to the concise Corsini Encyclopedia of Psychology and Behavioral Sciences. It stimulates the brain's frontal lobe, which is associated with higher cognitive processes and abstract thought, as well as perception and motor control. That can make it feel real. For this reason, mental imagery is an ideal portable training tool. Just imagine yourself kicking the ball or delivering the punchline, and you'll have better control over how your foot swings or your voice projects. In one study, running an imaginary course activated muscle patterns in the legs of skiers similar to those produced by actual skiing. The phenomenon, known as the Carpenter effect, has also been seen in studies of tennis and volleyball teams. Athletes with closed eyes swaying through an imaginary course have become a common sight in the starting areas of ski races and bobsled tracks. Mental imagery can supplement perceptual input, but it can be equally useful when perceptual input is painful, tedious, or lacking. A prisoner in Supermax can use the imagery to create the space and time that confinement strips away. While he was in the box, Perez talked to himself out loud. He kept journals. For a while, he wrote out and responded to famous quotations. He also used his mind to time travel, imagining alternate endings to past interactions with people. What if I said this? Or what if I would have invited her for coffee or something like that? He wrote about a painful relationships and episodes, reframing them and extracting a lesson. Memory is both constructive and reproductive, said Alex Schlegel, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of California, Santa Barbara. In fact, imagination and memory run on parallel tracks in the brain. By engaging his imagination, Perez was able to rewrite his past in a more positive light and reframe his future. I used to lie in bed with my eyes closed, said Perez, thinking about my past, thinking about my future, planning for the future. Some of it was based on reality, and the other, borderline fantasy. He tapped into a tunnel-like experience, creating a personal space for himself inside the tiny physical space of his cell. Over time, he got more intentional about how he was using his time in his mental workspace, as Schlegel refers to the overlapping networks that allow intentional imagination to take place. Perez believes what he ended up doing bordered on meditation. Michael Jewell, a Texas inmate, had a similar experience. After Jewell's 1970 death sentence was commuted to life imprisonment, he served 40 years, 7 of which were spent in near-total isolation. He says he used to kill time for hours working out detailed visualizations of himself in a vivid alternate reality, where he could inhabit open spaces and converse with people. I might imagine myself at a park and come upon a person sitting on a bench, he says. I would ask if she or he minded if I sat down. I'd say something like, "Great weather today." The other person would respond something like, "It is indeed. I hope it continues until the football game." As we conversed, I would watch joggers, bicyclists, and skateboarders pass by. The conversation might go on for half an hour or so. When I opened my eyes and stood, I would feel refreshed and even invigorated. As with Perez, the result was self-improvement in the most unlikely circumstances. I was an exception to the rule, Jewell writes. I went out better than I came in. In a sense, Jewell didn't have much of a choice. A survivor of intense childhood trauma and abuse, he says the constant presence of mental goblins threatened to consume him when he entered solitary. His willful and directed imagination was a reaction to those goblins and helped him to defeat them. Now on parole, Jewell is active on many prison reform boards and is a director of Texas Cure, an organization that works on prison reform. That Perez and Jewell had an active imagined life in solitary is, in a sense, unsurprising. Isolation naturally encourages the generation of mental imagery because imagination and perception occur along parallel neural pathways and are constantly competing for attention. The more there is to perceive, the less intense our mental imagery will be. Conversely, reduced sensory stimulation can allow for a vivid and stable mental imagery, says David Pearson, a cognitive psychologist at Anglia Ruskin University. This correlation has been documented before. Isolation has been linked to creativity. But simply imagining something is not enough to improve well-being. In fact, uncontrolled or intrusive mental images can be both causative and symptomatic of mental illness. Social anxiety sufferers, for example, are plagued with involuntary images of themselves performing badly in social situations. A stutterer might picture himself stumbling over a word repeatedly. The problem is particularly severe in prison. 55% of male and 73% of female inmates in U.S. state prisons suffer from some form of mental illness. Uncontrolled and intentional imagination lead to very different outcomes. They even activate different parts of the brain. The default mode network, which goes online when we let our minds wander, is associated with uncontrolled imagination. Controlled imagination activates the dorsal attention network, which is linked to self-control, and the impairment of which might be implicated in psychological disorders like substance dependence and attention deficit disorder. Which kind of imagination is activated may come down simply to character. Angela Duckworth was teaching 7th grade math in New York City public school when she noticed that intelligence was not always the best predictor of which of her students would succeed. There was another key ingredient: the ability to demonstrate effort and passion over time, a quality she called grit. Duckworth went on to obtain a doctorate in psychology at the University of Pennsylvania and developed her hypotheses further. She has since researched West Point Military Academy cadets, National Spelling Bee competitors, rookie teachers in low-income neighborhoods, and salespeople at top companies. Across all of these professions, she has found grit to be a key ingredient in achievement. Students who self-report high grit levels are more likely to succeed in school than non-gritty students, even more intelligent ones. But grit isn't just about achievement. In fact, achievement can obscure grit. Duckworth writes, "Whereas individuals high in need for achievement pursue goals that are neither too easy nor too hard, individuals high in grit deliberately set for themselves extremely long-term objectives and do not swerve from them, even in the absence of positive feedback." There's not much in the way of positive feedback in solitary confinement. Success is almost completely unrecognized by others and entirely dependent on the goals you set yourself. Schlegel posits that prisoners who thrive in solitary confinement probably have extra high levels of grit. There's this motivation aspect to creativity that's really separate from anything to do with imagination, he says. The idea of motivation is very underappreciated. For this article, Perez and Jewell took an online test through the University of Pennsylvania's Grit Lab that measured their grit on a scale from 1 to 5. The test measures qualities like an individual's consistency of interests. I often set a new goal but later choose to pursue a different one. And perseverance of effort. I have achieved a goal that took years of work. Both Jewell and Perez scored a 4.25, meaning they are grittier than 90% of the U.S. population. Jewell agrees that grit may have played a role in his anomalous Supermax experience and says that his upbringing may have made him grittier than his counterparts. For his part, Perez says that the experience of confinement has made him even grittier. "The way I see it is like this," he says. "I have been to the bottom of the barrel and have emerged more resilient, smarter, more determined to succeed, and more appreciative about the small things in life. I learned to eliminate the pain by finding pleasure in the pain, to turn stuff into sugar." Grit and imagination got him through and helped make him who he is today. At the same time, he says, he didn't need all those years in prison to get the message. "Would I take it back?" Perez chuckles and leans back, shaking his head. "Yeah, probably." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Nautil, Nautil.us. On the health and science page, a new way of seeing the universe. Albert Einstein predicted the existence of gravitational waves 100 years ago, but these elusive ripples in the fabric of space-time have never actually been detected. Until now. After decades of hunting, scientists have identified an unmistakable gravitational wave signal, which resulted from the collision of two black holes in deep space from about 1.3 billion light-years away, the Washington Post reports. The discovery was made with the help of two extraordinarily sensitive U.S. laser detectors situated 2,000 miles apart, which make up the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO. It's the first time the university has spoken, it's the first time the universe has spoken to us through gravitational waves, said David Reitz, executive director of LIGO. Up until now, we've been deaf. In his General Theory of Relativity, Einstein predicted that cataclysmic cosmic events would create gravitational waves that would ripple outward through the fabric of space-time at the speed of light. The LIGO system detected a shift in space-time smaller than the width of an atom, along with a chirp emitted when the black holes merged. The discovery of gravitational waves gives astronomers a new way of seeing and getting information about mysterious objects that emit no light, such as black holes and neutron stars. What's really exciting is what comes next, Reed says. We're opening a window on the universe, a window of gravitational wave astronomy. And moving right on into the talking points page. Syria, why Assad and Putin have won. President Obama has spent 5 years insisting there is no military solution to the Syrian civil war, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Russian President Vladimir Putin is about to prove him wrong. Russia, the U.S., and the other nations involved in Syria's bloody conflict last week agreed to a temporary ceasefire that supposedly will come into force this week. The agreement will ostensibly allow the delivery of humanitarian aid to Syria's millions of starving civilians and jumpstart the postponed Geneva peace talks. But in reality, this looks like another Russian victory. Under the pretense of targeting terrorists, Russia has been pounding the rebel-held city of Aleppo with airstrikes, clearing the way for Syrian government forces to move in. Once Aleppo falls, Putin can then freeze the conflict in place at the peace talks, allowing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to consolidate his strategic gains. The deal isn't entirely cynical or useless, said Fred Kaplan at Slate.com. Humanitarian aid is desperately needed, and getting any agreement out of such diverse and contentious powers, including Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, is an accomplishment of sorts. Alas, the terms of the ceasefire are riddled with loopholes. They exclude military action against ISIS, the al-Nusra Front, and any other terrorist organization, a term Russia applies to any group opposing Assad. If Assad stays in power, he will have little interest in eradicating ISIS, said Noah Feldman in BloombergView.com. Instead, he'll focus on reestablishing some semblance of sovereignty in Syria and tacitly cede some territory to ISIS, allowing the terrorist group to become a long-term de facto state. There have never been any good options in Syria, but even the bad options keep getting fewer and worse, said Joshua Keating in Slate.com. It's now too late for the U.S. to arm and prop up a viable opposition to Assad or establish a no-fly zone, unless President Obama wants to order a full military U.S. confrontation with Assad and Russia. Allowing the brutal Assad to win, on the other hand, would likely result in the slaughter of more Sunni civilians and a humanitarian catastrophe, even by Syria's grim standards. A year ago, the U.S. might have earned some influence over Syria's future if it had acted decisively. But at this point, none of the options seems likely to prevent more years of fighting, more suffering, and more mass displacement. Then we'll wind down the hour with some shorter notes. The disparity in lifespan between America's rich and poor is widening, according to a new Brookings Institution report. For men born in 1920, there was a 6-year difference in the lifespans of the top 10% and bottom 10% of earners. For men born in 1950, there was a 14-year difference. For women, the gap more than doubled during this period, from a 4.7-year difference to 13. Justice Antonin Scalia is only the third Supreme Court justice to die on the bench in the past 63 years. Chief Justice William Rehnquist died in 2005, and Chief Justice Fred Vinson died in 1953. The other justices who left the bench during this period all retired. Most science teachers in high schools across the country are teaching their students about climate change, but 30% told students that warming temperatures are likely due to natural causes, according to a new study. Another 31% are teaching both the natural causes theory and the overwhelming scientific consensus that climate change is fueled by human activity. On the poll watch, 29% of Americans held a favorable view of the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia in a poll taken last summer. 27% viewed him unfavorably. 32% of Americans had never heard of Scalia. And we'll finish up with a quote from Sid Caesar. He says, "The trouble with telling a good story is that it invariably reminds the other fellow of a dull one." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.